Good day, and welcome to the Teneo Insights call. Today's call is being recorded. If you would like to ask a question during today's call, please press star one on your telephone keypad. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Kevin Kajiwara. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much, Lauren. Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, and thank you for joining today's Teneo Insights call. I'm Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. And thank you for joining our latest call on the coronavirus and its impact politically, economically, and on companies. Joining me today, we've got a number of my colleagues to discuss a number of issues. First, we'll start, as ever, with where we are on the disease outbreak itself. And we will have Dr. Jerry Hauer, who's a senior advisor to Teneo Risk. Many of you will recognize his voice on here. He's a leading expert in emergency response and management and crisis planning. Jerry was the commissioner of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services for the state of New York and the director of the Office of Counterterrorism. He was also the acting assistant secretary for the Office of Public Health Emergency Preparedness at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It is April, so we are moving into proxy season, obviously raising a lot of questions on the governance front. And to help us with that, we have Martha Carter. Martha is a vice chair of Teneo and the head of our governance advisory business. She focuses on shareholder engagement, activism defense, executive compensation, and all other matters of governance best practices for C-suites and boards. And she was previously the head of global research at ISS. We'll then turn our attention to what is happening in Washington following the passage of the fiscal bill last week. Joining me are Orson Porter. He's a senior managing director and the head of Teneo's Washington office who leads our government affairs efforts. Orson was the U.S. director of government and public affairs for Nike and previously served in the White House as a special assistant to Bill Clinton. Running counterpoint to him is Tony Sayegh. He's a managing director with Teneo, advising clients on strategic communications, public affairs, government relations and media. Tony joined Teneo following a stint in the Trump administration. He was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, leading the Office of Public Affairs for Secretary Mnuchin. Finally, we're going to turn our attention to China, which is something we will be doing with increasing frequency in our future calls as China tries to reemerge from the impact of the coronavirus. Joining me today is Gabriel Wildow. He's a senior vice president in the Teneo political risk advisory business. He heads up our analysis of China in the U.S., and Gabe was formerly the Shanghai bureau chief for the Financial Times. As the operator mentioned at the beginning, there will be time for questions at the end of this. Let me just start here by saying that the world will hit a milestone today with the 1 millionth confirmed case globally. Meanwhile, as we've all seen, the global economy has really hit a wall, the latest evidence being the initial jobless claims number in the United States, which just dropped a moment ago, in excess of 6.6 million. That comes on top of the $3.3 million record number that we saw last week. That number last week was already implying an unemployment rate of over 5.5% for April, so clearly we are now looking at over 10 million jobs lost in just the last two weeks or filed unemployment. The news and prognosis for the virus has also not been encouraging over the last week. It's really difficult to believe at this point that on March the 1st, the U.S. had 70 reported cases. By the end of the month, 183,000. Today, we're at about 220,000, which is double that of any other country. With that, let's get started. Jerry, why don't you bring us up to date on the outbreak and the trajectory and the latest we've learned on the science here.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Good morning, everyone. Let me start with the current numbers. As Kevin mentioned, we're approaching a million cases worldwide, and we're rapidly approaching about 50,000 deaths worldwide. Here in the U.S., we're at about 217,000 cases with about 5,100 deaths. One of the things we continue to see is this escalation in both Spain and Italy. Spain has 170,000 cases and 10,000 deaths, with Italy at 110,000 cases and 1,300 deaths. At the current rate, I fully expect to see over 10,000 deaths in the next 5 to 6 days here in the U.S. We're going to see an accelerated pace over the next several weeks, where we'll see 2 to 3 times the number of deaths that we're seeing now as we start to reach the peak. One of the things I've been asked is why the case fatality rate is so high in Italy. Right now, it hovers at around 10%. By comparison, worldwide, the case fatality rate is about 3.4%. And in China, it was about 2 to 3%. Contributing to this high number of deaths is a number of factors. One, the age of the population. Many of the deaths are in people between 80 and 90 years old. The other factor that has played a big role is the number of hospitals that are and were and continue to be overwhelmed by the number of cases. And being overwhelmed, they've had to make very difficult decisions about the length of time they keep people on respirators and when they choose to humanely terminate care for a number of these people. The other thing that has come up in looking at deaths in Italy is because they're so overwhelmed, they have found that the deaths that are not even attributable to COVID-19 are being classified as COVID-related deaths, and they feel that that's driving up the case fatality rate. Let me turn to one of the topics that Kevin mentioned, and that's the question of how long this epidemic will last here in the U.S. There are a number of models describing the overall path of the outbreak, and several describing the various components of the outbreak. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation is projecting about 93,000 deaths here in the U.S. They are also projecting about 16,000 deaths in New York. Personally, I think those numbers are low. I think we'll be over 100,000 deaths in the U.S., and I think we'll be closer to 17,000 or 18,000 deaths in New York State. They have the trajectory of the number of deaths lasting right through July. You have to realize that people on ventilators that are put on ventilators in May may be on the ventilator for 30 days or more. Their survival at 30 days is very low. But some of those people will die 30 days down the road, so the deaths will continue into late June or July. Another model has the pandemic and the demand for beds peaking at the end of April. If you look at what Andrew Cuomo is projecting, his numbers and his projections have the peak somewhere in the next 15 days. This is a very fluid situation, so the models are not exact at this point. One of the experts at the University of Pennsylvania believes that with strict adherence to self-quarantine, we could see easing of the situation in June. And some counties within the U.S. could be eased, or there could be lax restrictions sooner than that. Another model at this point in time has a two-phase approach. It's a model I tend to like. It involves aggressive control, aggressive treatment, and quarantine and testing. In essence, what it does is it clamps things down to ensure that there is an aggressive control of quarantine and isolation, and ensuring that hospitals are prepared to treat the large number of cases they'll be seeing. Phase two of that model allows businesses and universities to reopen, but remote working continues and social gatherings are limited. Key to that phase two is keeping the vulnerable populations, those over 60 to 65, would continue to be self-quarantined for a longer period of time, possibly going into July or August. With that phase two, there is the ability, because of the controls and quarantine and treatment capabilities, to, if there is a spread, to revert back to phase one and clamp things down again. Phase two will end when we have vaccines, when the other treatments are available, and when testing is more widespread. This is a more measured geographic approach, and the bottom line as we move forward. And I know it's not what people want to hear, but the bottom line is, despite calls to reopen the country quickly, I think we are inside, in self-quarantine, at least through May, although there will be a desire to use the phase two approach and open parts of the country and declare victory. I don't see that being a widespread type of activity at this point in time. So I think that 2 to 3 months is minimum, and for a large portion of the population, scaling up could be 4 months down the road, if not 5. Kevin, I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, one other question for you, Jerry, on this front. You know, at the outset of this, it really appeared that it was older people and people with pre-existing conditions that were the most impacted and most vulnerable. However, the data in the United States is showing that this skews much younger than originally thought. Any comment on that?
Yeah, sure, Kevin. The 20% roughly of the cases here in the United States are in the population between 20 and about 45 years old. We're also, unfortunately, starting to see some deaths in very young kids. We had 2 deaths in the last week that were in infants, not something that we saw reported in China.
Got it. Understood. Well, so clearly the message here is that this is going to last much longer, but without a whole lot of certainty, given the variety of models that we're seeing out there. But as I mentioned at the outset, we're in April, and we're heading into the heart of proxy season. So, Martha, I want to turn to you, you know, and see what some of the major governance trends you're seeing are. I mean, it appears that things like virtual meetings appear to be accepted now by investors as a new normal, for example. But are investors changing their views or giving companies a pass this proxy season?
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. And as you said, you know, the world has gone to virtual annual shareholder meetings. I think when we were on this call a couple of weeks ago, I talked about companies thinking about it. And, of course, the world has moved rapidly in 2 weeks' time. So the only thing left on virtual meetings, which is now a necessity, is really on the how-tos, how to have two-way dialogue with investors as you do it, how to have a transparent question and answer session, and so on. So with regard to virtual meetings, if you have any specifics or questions on the how to do, we did publish an article on it that's available on our website. So beyond that, we're really seeing investors and proxy advisors expect good governance and effective leadership during the crisis. There's some major investors out there that are signaling pretty clearly that they're not letting up on their views and their demands regarding all of ESG, the E, the S, and the G. BlackRock, for example, stated in January in its annual letter that sustainability is really at the core of investment for them. And they've indicated recently they're going to keep the pressure on companies and hold them to the governance standards that they expect. And State Street Global Advisors, SSGA, pretty much followed suit just a couple days ago. They put out proxy season guidance and indicated that they recognize that right now the engagement conversations with companies are going to shift, but that they really believe that ESG issues have to be part of the bigger picture and clearly articulated as part of the company's overall business strategy, and that was from SSGA. So these are pretty clear messages that ESG is going to continue to matter for these investors.
Yeah, I want to follow up on the ESG front in a second here, but you just mentioned the proxy advisors and their expectations. Where are they allowing some latitude for companies?
Well, there is a bit of discretion coming from proxy advisor, and of course, the first place we saw it was on those virtual shareholder meetings. It's typically a stance that they haven't liked all that much, feeling that it disenfranchised shareholders' ability to participate. They've certainly softened their view on that by necessity. And it's a little early to tell where ISS and Glass Lewis will come out. As we are in proxy season, we'll know a lot more by the end of it, and as we see all of these issues roll up into the aggregate. It seems to be right now that ISS and Glass Lewis are continuing to apply their voting policies as they normally do, so whether it's say on pay, director elections, shareholder proposals. But one thing that's notable, Glass Lewis recently put out a pretty detailed message regarding how they view this year in the lens of the crisis, how they view discretion, things that they are looking at, including executive compensation, including board diversity, capital allocation, and so on. And that article and a number of others we actually have cited in our latest Teneo Insights piece, which we just posted on stakeholder capitalism and ESG.
So you've mentioned ESG a few times now, so I want to get back to that. Obviously, it's been such a critical element over the last couple of years. So it sounds to me from what you're saying that ESG is in the midst of this crisis is certainly not taking a back seat and that the focus is going to continue by large investors.
Investors don't want the momentum that's been gained in ESG to really let up. I've mentioned the BlackRock and State Street, but this is plenty of other investors as well. And if we can go back in time a bit to one of the last crises that we lived through and any lessons learned after the 2008 financial crisis, we really saw a big increase in ESG. If for those that lived through that, think back to the PRI signatories, just a complete proliferation of investor stewardship codes all around the world. We had the advent of Say on Pay. We just had a tremendous increase in focusing in on stakeholder views, shareholder engagement. And speaking of stakeholder views, companies put their stake in the ground on stakeholder views last summer with the corporate purpose statement by the Business Roundtable that was published last August that people will remember had a lot of signatories, over 180 corporate signatories. So investors are looking for boards and management to really be effective leaders over all of the letters in that alphabet, E, S, and G. And S looms large. Human capital management plays a big role this year. It goes without saying. There's a lot of news on employee comp and benefits, worker conditions, worker safety during this pandemic. There's been a lot of companies, too, that have done a great job of putting out disclosures on the level of support that they're providing to their community, whether it's through donations, foundations. So communicating all of these actions to shareholders is really going to be an important part, not just of companies' disclosures this year, but also rolling into next proxy season.
So, you know, just coming beyond that, I mean, you obviously speak to a lot of our clients at the highest levels. And you're also familiar with what institutional investors want to know. So what do you think? I mean, what do companies really need to be ready for now?
Yeah, certainly be ready for some tough questions. There's going to be questions during the virtual shareholder meetings that you have. Companies are looking at shareholder engagement, probably most of which will happen off proxy season, so later on in the year. But investors are going to be looking on several areas of focus. Executive compensation is going to be big, and some of those decisions have yet to play out. Compensation committees are going to be taking a look over the summer and into the fall at some key decisions. Things like paying out retention awards where incentive plans haven't paid out, or modifying awards that use relative TSR, or making decisions on executive compensation where the backdrop is that there's been a lot of layoffs of rank-and-file employees. So really good rationale under the umbrella of everything that's happened this year is going to be very important. And then board oversight, especially in the human capital management area, is going to be really important. And then, back to old school takeover defenses, we may likely see a return of poison pills, and that's going to have to be carefully managed as well. And then back to where I began, which was just a statement by BlackRock, they've really signaled something that they signaled before, which is they expect companies to be compliant with the frameworks for SASB and TCFD by the end of the year. So all in all, a lot of topics for companies to engage with shareholders during and after the crisis. And like any crisis, at the end of this, there's going to be winners and losers, and we focus a lot on who survives from a financial perspective. But really, companies and boards that demonstrate effective leadership and oversight are going to be the ones that really survive, and they're going to have to do that in all areas of governance.
Yeah, thanks, Martha. And I just want to reiterate for our audience that Martha and her team have been doing a lot of work and actually writing on this as well, and that is accessible on the Teneo website, or also you can contact your Teneo contact, and they'll get it to you. So thank you. I want to move now to what's happening in Washington. Obviously, we passed and signed since our last call on Thursday of last week, the biggest fiscal deal in U.S. history. So let's turn now to the implementation. Tony, last week you had indicated that, you know, passing the bill, as giant as it was, and requiring the bipartisan support that it had, was in fact actually the easy part. And now the work really needs to begin to set up the mechanics of how this is going to be efficiently deployed and in a timely fashion. And it functions with the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, other agencies and the like. So Tony, so far, a week into this thing, how is this playing out? I know that they're requesting an application deadline of Friday. I believe American Airlines and Southwest Airlines have indicated they are applying. But how are things playing out?
That's right, Kevin. So I think the biggest part of the goal was to immediately release massive amounts of liquidity into these businesses to prevent ongoing job losses. And you know, the number you started with on the call of 6.7 million losses reported now and 10 million if you combine it from last week. I mean, that's staggering. That's precisely what the administration and Congress worked together to try to mitigate it as much as possible. So this week at Treasury, which is really the agency that's been tasked with most of the implementation of the Phase 3 bill, you've had a focus on releasing some guidance and clarity immediately on employee retention programs, unemployment insurance, paid sick leave, and payroll protection, largely focused on companies making sure they're keeping their payrolls and keeping their employees whole during the next 8 weeks, which is what they built Phase 3 around, keeping stabilization of the labor market and the economy over the next 2 months, essentially. The biggest piece, I think, is going to kind of be announced in the next 24 hours is the SBA loan program, and part of that is the loan forgiveness aspect. If these small businesses of under 500 employees utilize the loans for operating costs and payrolls. I'm pretty sure the president today, during his press conference, will highlight, and that's the one toward the end of the day, I believe around 5 o'clock possibly, highlights some of these provisions, because as of tomorrow, these loan applications are going to start being accepted by the banks. And I would expect the president and others to be upfront about the fact that this is going to get tricky. There's going to be an overwhelming amount of, obviously, requests for these loans. The banks have been working with the administration, particularly the bigger banks, Bank of America, Goldman, and others, to try to work the system out. It's going to have kinks, and I think, you know, there is going to be a little pain up front. But I think the ultimate goal of the administration is to reassure businesses the money will be there, and you will get it, and your employees, you know, will be able to be paid if you apply for this program. And there are some kinks. Two that I've kind of noticed is, if you're an existing SBA 7(a) loan recipient, you probably have a better shot at getting it, and at least quickly. And that's something that's going to have to be worked out, because many businesses are not existing recipients of the 7(a) program. Number one. Number two, I think you have an issue where community and regional banks have not been set up yet to provide these loans. So they're going to have to work on those two things. But that's going to be a large part of today. And, you know, all this stuff has to be worked out sooner than later. And this is something that you're seeing the administration focused on 24/7. I would just add one last thing on implementation and Treasury. Last week I detailed the, you know, $500 billion lending authority within Treasury, and then when you combine it with the Fed, over $4 trillion lending authority. It is becoming evident that Treasury is going to be running this program with a lot of their existing team. It's very likely that the Deputy Secretary, Justin Muzinich, begins to run point on administering this $500 billion lending authority. You have Brent McIntosh, who's our Undersecretary for International Affairs, who's kind of working along the airline kind of group, and he's going to be leading the team that works on airline-related relief. And then you have the small business programs and loans being administered by a few of the assistant secretaries in economic policy and domestic finance. So Treasury is definitely trying to quickly, it was passed last Friday, we're now on Thursday, not even a week, quickly put together all of the infrastructure necessary to deploy the programs that were passed by Congress and signed by the president.
Yeah, thanks. Orson, I'm interested, you know, to sort of get an indication from you what the priorities are at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. I mean, you know, Tony has just indicated the speed with which they want to implement all of the tools that were enabled by the legislation last week. But it strikes me that, you know, every single day, street estimates of for the economy and for unemployment continue to deteriorate, as evidenced by the number this morning. And you know, when you think about the fiscal deal, you know, which has been referred to as stimulus, but I would suggest it's really more a survival bill than a stimulus bill at this point. You know, 10% of GDP. I mean, if you were to back of the envelope spread that out over the course of the year, that's 1 month and 1 week. It seems like the question is, was it big enough, and is it happening fast enough, really? And therefore, is there more to come? We've heard the speaker already talking about a phase four. Where are we on priorities at the other end, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle?
Sure. You know, that's a good question, and brings up probably the most important piece of this is, you know, what are the politics? If I don't say anything that you should remember, note that there's 215 days until the election, and D.C., though, is responding to the crisis, is really revolved around the election day itself, and what they do dictates how quickly or how bipartisan or how enthusiastic they are towards doing things bipartisan will be in the coming months. So, but I think, you know, you see is that Congress is on recess, rightly or wrongly. To their credit, the leadership in both houses are here, which is a good thing. But, you know, D.C. is on lockdown, and as you announced earlier, you had nearly 7 million people file for unemployment. So if there's an issue with people receiving checks because the banks don't have people to work to receive the calls for the SBA loans, people are calling state offices who are calling lines that are not being answered because those two people are at home because they have to watch their kids. So the glitch is real. And as the glitch becomes harder to address, so will the partisan blame game come in. So having said that, I do see, you know, the rhetoric, particularly in Congress, becoming a little bit more partisan. You've seen the Democrats come out in support of an infrastructure bill, basically focused on things like water, roads, and expanding the broadband or the Internet, which is all good. President Trump rightly said that he would support any jobs bill. But, you know, Mitch McConnell immediately said that his concern was addressing the current crisis. We should slow the debate on any additional spending packages. And, you know, when his team or when the Senate comes back, he's going to really focus to a constituency base that he cares about, which will be appointments of judges. So all that to say is, you know, I think Dems will continue to talk about jobs and state support, supporting the governors, helping governors fill budget crises, et cetera. And you will see Republicans talk a lot about making certain the supply chain is well kept and to address any issues of the recently passed bill. But know that, you know, 215 days away is the election. As we move into May, that number gets smaller. As we move into June, the number gets smaller. Then it gets harder and harder to pass some of these major bills. So $2 trillion was an historic feat. They're now talking about another $2 trillion infrastructure bill. That's $4 trillion in a matter of weeks. That is a hard pill to swallow for a lot of Republicans and Democrats on both sides of the aisle. So I think, you know, you'll see a stronger partisan debate. You'll see the president kind of step back and allow Congress to figure it out. But if the sentiment and the poll numbers that they're worried about, that 215 days until the election, continues to drop, then the blame game starts and things get, you know, unfortunately, where they were before this all started, we find ourselves in gridlock.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, as I mentioned at the outset, we're going to open the floor to questions here in just a minute, and Lauren will re-instruct how to get into the queue. But before we do, I want to turn to Gabe and China. It's pretty clear that the world did not pay enough attention to China on the way into this crisis, and I don't think we should lose focus on China as we watch it attempt to both get out of the health crisis and to restart its economy. And to that end, we'll be focusing a lot on China in the weeks to come on this call. But for today, Gabe, I want to focus a little bit on the data. There's so much controversy and criticism of China. And I guess the big question when you cut through all of that is, what do we really see? Or what is it really telling us, and how reliable is it? You know, let's start with on the viral front itself. You know, in the wake of the U.S. intelligence report yesterday that came out that suggested that that China had been concealing the data at the highest levels, not just through the sort of the incompetence or incentives for lower levels of government. And then we've also seen one of the Chinese counties, Xi'an County, today going to lockdown again. So what are you seeing on the data on that front? How do you interpret that?
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, I think this is an important question for two reasons. One being the public health implications and the necessity of having accurate data. But beyond that, there's also this kind of global struggle to to this contest between the U.S. and China to control the narrative over this virus and China's very striking efforts over the last few weeks to position itself as a global leader in public health and to promote its accomplishments diplomatically to position itself as a provider of aid and as a model for other countries to follow controlling the virus. So, of course, if the numbers are false, then China's claims to global leadership are undermined. And we've seen the sniping between the U.S. and China, where we've seen very high-level officials, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Robert O'Brien, the National Security Advisor, saying very clearly they think the numbers are fake. Our view here, and we've been telling clients, is that broadly speaking, we believe that China's case count and death count is reliable. Now, that's not to say that it's precise. There may be a degree of undercounting for technical reasons, but we do not see evidence of a large-scale intentional cover-up. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The most important is that it's just simply not feasible for local government officials or central government officials to cover up a large number of cases. What we saw during the height of the outbreak in Wuhan is that despite the very intense censorship apparatus in place in China, word gets out when hospitals are overwhelmed, when there's patients flooding in, when there's widespread illness. People figure it out. It leaks onto social media. It leaks into the few handful of regular news media outlets that are able to have some freedom, that are independent to a degree, independent from the state, and able to report politically sensitive news. And that even if those stories or the social media posts eventually get deleted, people notice them before they're deleted. Beyond that, we can simply observe that that they're shutting down these field hospitals, these emergency hospitals are being shut down in Wuhan and elsewhere, and that's just not something you do if you're still suffering a major, if you're still on the upswing in terms of the outbreak. In terms of the incentives for local officials, what we see clearly is that, yes, there are incentives to restart the economy, and those incentives potentially create corresponding incentives to conceal the number of cases, but what we've argued is that the countervailing incentive not to cover up cases, there's a very stern warning from President Xi and Premier Li about punishments for local officials who do conceal cases are creating a countervailing incentive to be honest about the case count. And as you mentioned, in Hunan province, Jia County in Hunan province, which borders the epicenter of Hubei, they did reimpose a lockdown yesterday, which to me indicates that local officials are willing to admit where there's points of vulnerability to reimpose quarantine restrictions to slow down the economy. We've also seen other measures that indicate that officials are continuing to be cautious and to put virus control and prevention in some cases above restarting the economy or above restarting normal life. So we've seen that, for example, the college entrance exam, which usually takes place in June, has been postponed by a month to July. That's the famous Gaokao, a huge gathering of high school students all over the country. Movie theaters were closed after initially reopened. Movie theaters were closed. So taken together, that indicates that the virus control is still a very high policy priority despite the push to restart the economy.
And finally, what about on the economic front? Obviously, the data is lagging, and we're not seeing the real March numbers for a while yet. So we've been reliant on anecdotal information. But every one of these, whether it's electricity usage, traffic patterns, or the number of people standing online outside of an Apple store, there can be a counter argument for why those are actually, suggesting that people aren't taking the subway, so they're driving more. Hence the traffic patterns, and then there's no traffic on the weekends. Not letting as many people into the Apple store, so there's a longer line outside. Companies just turning on the machinery to suggest electricity usage so that they can say, yes, that they've restarted operations. What do you think about the data that we're seeing so far on the economic restart?
So you're right that there have been a lot of attempts to use kind of proxy indicators like electricity or traffic to get a handle on the degree of restart of the economic activity. The latest data we've seen out on Monday suggests that the restart has been slower than what some of the other data was suggesting. So the Purchasing Managers Index, the PMI, came out on Monday, and it showed a level of 52 for the manufacturing sector, where 50 is the threshold between expansion and contraction. And so 52 is a mild expansion, but importantly, it's an expansion off of – it's a month-on-month expansion. So February was way down at 36, well, you know, a historically low number. 36 is back where we were during the financial crisis, even lower. So that was February, and then we got up to 52 for March, which means a mild expansion over that very low base from February. So that suggests that the restart is proceeding, but proceeding pretty slowly. And the reasons for that are a few. I mean, people are still subject. There's some workers that are only still getting back to the major cities from their hometowns after the extended Lunar New Year. And then when they do get back, they're still subject to a 14-day quarantine in most cities. And we've also seen that companies are still being cautious. Even though they've restarted, they're still being cautious. So, for example, some people are coming back to the office or to the factory, but they're doing it in shifts. So only one half or one third of the normal amount of workers are actually present. And so when we see these headline numbers about the number of companies that have restarted, those may be accurate, but they're not operating at full capacity yet. And we see a continued amount of a high degree of caution in terms of companies not wanting to be blamed if there's an outbreak. We've seen some companies that have suffered new cases in recent weeks getting named and shamed by the government. So companies are still continuing to be cautious in terms of rushing back to work. And then we have the additional factors of who's going to buy these products, assuming the manufacturing sector gets back going. The rest of the world is headed into a deep recession, so global demand is weighing on the Chinese economy. And you still have some supply chain disruptions as well. I mentioned the labor shortages. So I think what the lesson learned from China is that economic restart, when it occurs, is going to be stepwise. It's going to be gradual. It's going to be halting. It's going to be sort of two steps forward, one step back. It's not just like flipping a switch.
That's why I say we're going to have to watch them very carefully going forward. So thank you, Gabe. Lauren, let's open the floor for questions. I'm aware of the time, so we want to get as many questions in as we can.
Thank you. And as a reminder, that is star one to ask a question. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, that is star one to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. Once again, that is star one to ask a question. And it appears we have no phone questions at this time.
Well, let me ask a follow-up then to Jerry. Jerry, we've had kind of a head-spinning number of, and quite frankly, for those of us who are lay people on this subject, it's very complex. But every single day we hear about a new therapy. Where we are in the vaccine development stage, therapies that are used for other, have historically been used for other illnesses, possibly being applicable here. Where are we on this? And, are there any silver bullets out there?
Yeah, Kevin, good question. Vaccines at this point in time, they're accelerating the pace at trying to get a vaccine developed. A vaccine will be very important in trying to ensure, if we have a second wave, that we have some kind of protection as that second wave evolves. Vaccine at this point in time is still 12 to 18 months out from here at a very minimum. The other therapeutics, there are over 60 different trials or therapeutics being looked at. The one that you hear about the most is Zithromax, an antibiotic, and hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malaria. The combination is supposed to reduce the viral load. That's being tested in a number of places now. We hope to see some preliminary data in a month or two, and that could be a very important therapeutic in trying to reduce the severity of the disease in people. There are then what's called the convalescent plasma, where you take people who you know have had COVID-19, you test them to make sure they no longer have virus, but that they have antibodies. You draw their plasma, you process it, and you give it to people who are either very sick or to healthcare workers to protect them. It boosts the level of antibodies, either in the sick person or in the healthcare worker. That, I think, we could probably see in a shorter period of time. In fact, what I'm reading is that they're looking at people who are in desperate situations. They're taking plasma from people known to have had the disease. They're not processing it. They're just giving them the plasma with antibodies to people who are in very serious condition.
And, you know, last week we saw an enormous amount of news regarding ventilators, both in terms of the shortages that many healthcare professionals and governors are talking about, and then some of the highly politicized battles we've seen in Washington over this. But can you just comment for one second? Because I know, you know, we've been talking about some of the auto manufacturers and other companies, for instance, starting to make ventilators. We've talked about companies that are rehabilitating old ventilators and the like. How complex are these machines? My understanding is that there are an awful lot of parts involved here, and the supply chains come from countries around the world, frankly. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Ventilators, Kevin, are fairly complex. They're complex not because of the physical components, but because of the IT component, the computer component, which regulates how often a patient is forced to inhale, is forced to exhale, what speed, what pressure it's at, detection of any anomalies. They're fairly complicated machines. And one of the reasons that the stockpile has not been as robust as we would have liked it to be is because of the complicated nature of the ventilators. Maintaining 75 or 100,000 ventilators is a very difficult process. It's not something you just pull off the shelf and say, we've got a working ventilator. They require at least yearly maintenance to make sure everything's working and to make sure the tubing hasn't begun to degrade.
Got it. And Gabe, I wanted to turn back to you for one second because, you know, you talked at the outset about the, you know, about some of the data coming out of China, and obviously there's been an incredulous response here. And one of those is that, you know, that China, once it kind of got its act together, imposed draconian social distancing measures. And at the same time, we have now imposed pretty draconian, certainly by American standards, social distancing measures in the United States. We certainly feel it here in New York. And yet, as Jerry has pointed out,
you know, the numbers continue to, you know, continue to go up. But it seems to me that we're not actually comparing apples to apples when we talk about social distancing measures. Is that fair? I mean, was China's markedly different than what we're doing here?
It was, Kevin. I mean, I think what I see in the U.S. is that social distancing is ramping up, but I think it is still difficult for people in the U.S. or elsewhere to really understand or to imagine the degree of fastidiousness and the extreme nature of some of the social distancing measures in China. I'll just give a few examples. I mean, maybe people have seen the pictures of the elevators with the tape on the floor where only four people can get in the elevator and it's divided into quadrants where each person stands. But beyond that, I mean, they were, many elevators had these kind of chopstick dispensers on the wall where you would take a single-use chopstick to use to push the button and then dispose of it in this receptacle that was essentially like one of those hazardous waste needle disposal baskets that you would see in a doctor's office. That's kind of a funny example, but everything from shopping from stores, we're starting to see this in the U.S., but, you know, waiting in line outside the store with each per person's space six feet apart. We were seeing the corporate dining halls. I mean, some of this is still in effect as people go back to work, but corporate dining halls where they have these long lunch tables and they set up these sort of dividers, these sort of makeshift cubicles so that each person was eating alone or had these dividers on either side of them at the table. We had controlled entry to apartment complexes, residential apartment complexes, so everyone in the complex would be issued an entry pass that you had to show to security guards. So if you didn't live there, you didn't have an entry pass and you couldn't go in. And so, you know, there was no visiting friends allowed. I mean, stuff like this was quite intense. And, I mean, we saw there was a video that circulated on the Internet where she was a Chinese-born person but a naturalized Australian citizen who was living in China, and her neighbors, there was a video of her neighbors confronting her after she'd come in from a run. She was supposed to be subject to 14-day quarantine. She went out for a run. Her neighbors scolded her. She sort of brushed them off. And then a few minutes later, the police show up, and she was deported back to Australia. So just for going on a run. To me, that is another reason to think that the numbers are, again, broadly reliable, because the degree of social distancing in China was just several notches above still where we are here in the U.S.
Great. Thank you. Lauren, are there still no questions?
We have no phone questions at this time.
Okay, great. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour, so we will wrap the call up here. I want to thank everybody for joining, and thank again Jerry Hauer and Martha Carter, Tony Sayegh and Orson Porter, and Gabe Wildow. You know, I cannot wait for the day when we can have a conference call on something else, but so long as this remains the primary story and the primary issue that all of you are confronting, we will continue to hold these conference calls every Thursday morning at this time, so please look out for the next invite. And with that, thank you very much, and have a good day. If you have any questions that did not get answered on this call, you can email us at TeneoInsights@Teneo.com, or, of course, contact your contact at Teneo. Thank you very much, and have a good rest of the week. Thank you.
And that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.